want is what you need, and what you need is what you want, and what you want is what you need, cause what you need is what you want. So what you want is what you need, so what you need is what you want, and what you want is what you need, so what you want you need it is. At Brick Pow Brick, community space here in Park Extension in the city. This is a live broadcast, standing up for a place to stay, movements confronting the housing crisis and false solutions. This broadcast is an attempt to look at a bunch of issues surrounding the housing crisis. We're very lucky to be joined by an amazing panel of live guests to speak about their respective community work to address the housing crisis, not just here in Montreal, Geogiage, but beyond. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is Free City Radio. We broadcast every Wednesday on CKUT, People Powered Radio, here in Montreal at 90.3 FM. And so I want to thank, first of all, Brick Pas Brick for hosting us. It's a live transmission. And also to our panelists. I will maybe first start to introduce each panelist, and we'll go that way. And you'll hear about their respective work. So I'd just ask each panelist to briefly introduce themselves. And we'll start just here beside me, Hubert Jérôme Blais, who's an artist and has been involved in housing organizing at a community-based level for a bunch of years in different capacities. So maybe just briefly introduce yourself and also the recent project that you've been working on.
Yeah, hi, thank you. So I'm Hubert Gendron Blais. I'm part of the collective Réverbération d'une crise, une enquête sonore sur le logement à Montréal. Réverbération d'une crise is a sound inquiry project made on the housing crisis in Geogiage, Montreal, made by a collective of tenants. Our goal was to make the housing crisis heard, and more specifically, some, let's say, existential, philosophical, maybe more personal also point of views.
Thank you so much. And we'll hear a bit more about this initiative, cultural initiative. After Hubert is Gaurav Sharma, who is a community organizer at the Immigrant Worker Center. You work a lot here in Park Extension. So yes. Please just introduce yourself and your work.
Yes, my name is Gaurav Sharma. I'm working with the IWC Immigrant Worker Center located at Van Horne. My organization focus on labor rights, worker rights, and also participating in a lot of housing revolutions, and also working with the Park X communities peoples, so Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshis, so such things. So we focus on these
across Canada and around the world. We have it all. Hard-hitting reports, eyewitness interviews, and in-depth documentaries exploring the issues without the corporate spin doctoring.
You know, there are two ways to go through life. One is to believe everything. The other is to believe nothing. Both ways avoid thinking.
Catch the news on Off the Hour, weekdays from 5 to 6 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Dear listeners, you're cued to CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial, www.ckut.ca on the internet. This hour presents what you don't hear or read in our mass media outlets. We're going to be talking about the conflict in Israel-Palestine. Please stay with us. Allowed humanity and who is not. Those deaths are tragedies worth praying, concerted attention to, and whose death can be dealt with in a matter of seconds. whose children are worth learning about, whose heartbreak is worth lingering over, and which people, when confronted by bloodshed, deserve to have the world put everything on hold and rush to their side. The answer is clear. Palestinians are killed by Israel all the time, including when they peacefully protest. But the world never puts itself on hold to bear witness to their heartbreak. So writes Jim Merkinson, an interim senior editor at The Nation magazine. The attacks by Hamas fighters in southern Israel on October 7 and the Israeli air attacks on Gaza that had followed, and now the unfolding humanitarian disaster there, once again expose fundamental bias in the state corporate news media. Does news coverage really convey the impression that all lives, Palestinian and Israeli, are of equal value? After all, they surely deserve the same level of humanity and compassion. Do the news media present heart-wrenching stories of individual victims and their grieving families from both sides? And is the full context and history explained in order for audiences to arrive at a proper understanding of events? This is what we would like to do today in Off the Hour. Please stay with us.
Yeah, I think that something that we should discuss before we wrap this up here is something we opened with, and that is, you know, listen, I understand that people are struggling with the idea of people who are under colonial occupation resisting it. And I think that 100 years ago or whatever, but we support slave revolt. But then the same kinds of people today are just horrified if Palestinians are really anybody under assault by imperialism, occupation, colonialism, whatever, stands up and hits back. So anyways, I know you had some things you wanted to say about that history that, you know, everybody wants to just pretend was like, you know, indigenous people throwing flowers at white settlers or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think you put it in the right context of just coming off Indigenous Peoples Day or weekend, however you want to look at it, here in the United States. And I mean, you know, listen, I mean, obviously the horrors of war are very clear to everyone, and it certainly can look, you know, very callous. But I mean, quite frankly, when you look at this context and this history and why it's important, I mean, these sorts of eruptions and types of resistance are exactly what happens when you have a totally asymmetric power balance, where people are completely and totally oppressed, where every single, you know, law or, you know, a treaty or agreement that's supposed to protect them is constantly violated. And when all the most powerful forces on earth seem to be colluding in that violation, you know, leaving them with very little recourse in terms of how they proceed, other than perhaps, you know, to resist or just to die. And I think that when we look at the history of the indigenous peoples, this is something that becomes extraordinarily clear. And I would encourage people really to read the history. I mean, when you look at things like the Powhatan Uprising in 1622, which happened in the area of Jamestown, where the Powhatan people, whose land was being so heavily encroached upon, they actually started to realize, happened again in the 1640s, by the way, the so-called Third Anglo-Powhatan War, they started to realize, hey, wait a second, these people are not actually here to be our friends. They're trying to take and to steal our land, and they will not leave. And every agreement we've made with them, they've broken. And in those cases, look at it, the Powhatans versus the English in the 1620s and the 1640s, they had no choice but to stand up and to fight back. And when you see what happened to them ultimately and how so many indigenous people were extinguished and genocided in this country, I think people look back and they say, well, yes, it makes sense. I mean, you should look at the Pueblo Revolt of 1680 in what's now New Mexico, where Pueblo people who were living under this brutal, you know, theocratic Spanish conquistador-imposed, you know, reality, where their communities are being totally and completely destroyed, their culture is being eviscerated. Just before that revolt, you know, a number of their traditional religious leaders just hanged and executed for not being on board with the Catholic theocratic realities. And those people rose up in what is now New Mexico. And yes, they killed many people, and many of them fall into, you know, the case of what we would call civilians. But they also evicted the Spanish from this area for 50 years to protect their cultural heritage and practices that people were coming to destroy in every possible way, and to destroy them along with it if they did not fall in line. And sometimes even when they did fall in line, you look at the Yamasee uprising of Native Americans as well. But you can also look, as you mentioned, at Nat Turner's rebellion. I mean, I think Nat Turner has rightfully become almost the reference point for slave rebellions here in the United States of America, because, you know, what some have deemed the Turner Cataclysm was so shocking to slave owners that it really rearranged the entire political scene of the United States and entered almost like a new phase of the struggle against slavery. And of course, Nat Turner's rebellion was widely hailed by abolitionists, certainly by all Black people living in the North, and by, you know, most Black slaves. But of course, Turner himself said subsequently that they did in fact use indiscriminate violence in the early parts of their raid, and on purpose, because he said they did it to try to strike fear into the hearts of the slave owners. They killed over 50 people in the course of, you know, not that long amount of time. And, you know, they weren't all slave owner, you know, older people or soldiers or whatever. Just read the history and you can see what it is. And of course, when we're talking about the Native Americans, when we're talking about Nat Turner, this was exactly what was said about them at the time, that they're ruthless, that they're bloodthirsty, that they're murderous barbarians, they're animals, that we have to do everything possible to kill them, which is why every uprising of indigenous peoples in America was then subsequently used by the settlers themselves to increase their level of violence by saying, look at how, you know, these people are so savage and so barbarous. The same thing with the slave uprisings that we saw over and over and over again. The Haitian Revolution is another great example of that. You know, everything that was being said at the time of the Haitian Revolution towards these Haitian revolutionaries by world public opinion was the same thing. I mean, the term terrorist wasn't in use then, but they're calling people devils and murderous and barbarous and doing the worst things possible. And, you know, all of that was not false. There was a very violent uprising where these slaves, you know, took control of their own lives and their own destinies. But of course, when we look back on that in history, we look back on it differently. We look back on Indigenous Peoples Day and the many positive things that are coming from that. And we say, yes, we need to get rid of, you know, for instance, these racist mascots. And we don't want to celebrate this old cowboys and Indians, old Western shoot 'em up style of American history. And I agree, we should not celebrate that. But we also can't forget that when we think about those old Westerns, and some of us, you know, even when we'd watch those old Westerns, we'd think, man, I wish the Indians could win one of these. Well, when the Indians really did win, they were brutally and totally, destroyed from a public opinion standpoint. And then subsequently, you know, physically in the further offensives that went on. But, you know, when the Indians really won, they were all called murderers and the worst possible people ever. And I'm not saying that to be callous. I'm not saying that to both sides it. But I think that it's very easy to look back in history and say, well, it was 400 years ago. It all seemed justified, without putting ourselves in the shoes of where Palestinians are today, where they feel like they are in an extraordinarily similar situation, and I do not disagree with them that they are. I mean, you look at the context of what's going on, the total asymmetrical power relationship that they are in, the fact that every single international law that is supposed to protect them is violated every hour of every day, and no one cares, and the most powerful nations on earth actually collude to make sure that Israel never sees any sort of responsibility or accountability for violating things that even these governments say is illegal, and the subsequent realities that have come from that. I mean, we've said it again and again, but I'll just say it one more time here to close, to give people a sense. You know, 158,967 Palestinians killed or injured between 2008 and September of 2023, as compared to 6,615 Israelis. Their land is stolen on a regular basis. The settlers who are coming into the West Bank and other parts of this, who are just stealing land despite the fact it's a allegedly illegal, olive fields being uprooted, sewage being pumped into fields so that people are not allowed to farm, the Gaza Strip, where people are trapped in the most, densely populated area on earth without any, you know, water or electricity. Let me read you this, Rania, and this comes from just before this ever happened. From 2020, this is the Washington Post. There's not enough electricity and infrastructure to run Gaza's war-ravaged sewage system. Hospitals, schools, homes are similarly running on empty, worn down by the lack of clean water, electricity, infrastructure, and jobs or money. Barely anyone has enough clean water to drink. The only local source of drinking water, the coastal aquifer, is full of dirty, salty water. And I said it before, 500 to 700 children, some as young as 12, arrested every single year the number one crime is rock throwing, 86% of them reporting they were beaten by grown adults while in detention. An average of 100 children killed every single year for 23 years in Palestine. I could go on and on and on in places like Hebron, where they're taking people's homes and they seal up their back doors because they say, well, you can't walk into the back alley because Palestinians aren't allowed to go there. This is an Israelis only, which really means Jews only, area where you can walk. And that's not to say anything about religion, but it is to show about the religion of the people themselves, but it is to show that the Israeli government is using an ethno-religious exclusive apartheid reality. They're dividing the land in every possible way. You know, in Gaza, 45% of people who apply to get out of Gaza to get medical treatment because of what we've already heard, that there's inadequate medical care, it's just flatly denied. And for the 55% who are allowed, which includes cancer patients and people like that, you can wait 6, 7, 8 hours at a checkpoint just to have some teenager, just because they want to have fun, tell you to turn around and you're not able to get your chemotherapy. I mean, this is the daily violence, brutality, death, humiliation, apartheid that people are living under in Palestine. And the fact of the matter is, the reason why there are so many people who can't say that this is somewhat akin to what we've seen with the indigenous peoples in America, that it's akin to what we saw with the slave rebellions in America. The reason they can't say it is because they can't come to terms with that reality, that the project of Israel is an apartheid project that is designed to destroy the Palestinian people in every way possible, to steal their land and impose a reality on them that they don't want and kill them if they stand up or say anything about it. They don't even have to stand up and do anything. And they want to think that that's a just project. It's not a just project. And this is why you've seen, it's not just Hamas. And I'll close on this. The whole idea that this is just Hamas is all designed to play into the Islamophobia of Americans, to say it's just a bunch of crazy Islamic radicals. That's why the Israeli forces are now calling Hamas ISIS Gaza. The reality is every Palestinian faction, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Palestinian People's Party, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, all of them of various different ideologies, religions, secular and different things, are all supporting this 100%. It's why, as our colleague Kate Pritzker put out in a recent video, why you have almost all of the NGOs in Gaza and in Palestine saying, we put 100% of the blame on the Israelis. There's a reason why Palestinians feel united. And it's not because they love war. It's not because they're beast and because they're violent and because they're bloodthirsty. But they're in a totally asymmetric power relation where no one anywhere does anything to help them ever. And the people who have the power to change their life and relieve their suffering are complicit in their oppression every single day, and the covering up of that crime, which is exactly what we see right now in terms of how many of these Western governments are approaching this. And in that context, just like the Powhatan in Virginia in the 1620s and the 1640s, just like the Pueblo in what is now New Mexico in the 1680s, just like Nat Turner, just like Gabriel Prosser, just like the Stono Rebellion, just like the Haitian Revolution, just like all of those people, the Palestinians are finally saying, you know, if no one is going to do anything for us, we have to do something for ourselves. War is not pretty. It's never something that is fun, but it is a reality that's here. And people have to ask themselves, which side are you on in this kind of conflict? You have to look at those historical precedents. And if you want to say, I value Indigenous Peoples Day in America, if you want to say you value the tradition of Black people in America freeing themselves from slavery, then you have to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians resisting their oppression today. And I know a lot of people don't like to hear that, and they don't like to see and hear people have solidarity with resistance, but they have to put it into that context, and they have to understand the 75 years of total dispossession, marginalization, oppression, and exploitation that Palestinians have been subject to, with no aid from the outside except from average everyday people.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial. This interview was conducted with Eugene Perrier, African American journalist for Breakthrough News. When we come back, an exclusive interview with Ihab Lutayef, well-known activist in Montreal. on the dial www.ckut.ca on the internet. Last Friday, Israel ordered all Palestinians in the northern half of the coastal strip, around 1.1 million people, out of a total population of 2.3 million, to move south within 24 hours. A senior legal advisor to Human Rights Watch warned that there is no safe place for them to go, even if they were able to travel. Quote, when the roads are rubble, fuel is scarce, and the main hospital is in the evacuation zone, he added. World leaders should speak up now before it is too late. Oxfam said, there is no single square meter in Gaza that is safe. It's all under attack. The UN warned of devastating humanitarian consequences should Israel insist that its demand be upheld. The Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council called upon Israel to reverse its ultimatum, warning that it would amount to the war crime of forcible transfer. In the studio with us, we have Ihab Lutayef, well-known activist in Montreal. He stood today in front of the office of MP Mark Miller. Ihab, you were at the office this morning and you barricaded yourself. What was the purpose of this action?
Mark Miller is my MP. He is a close confidant of Justin Trudeau and a personal friend. This is well known. He is Minister of Immigration now, and before that he handled the native file. He handled the native file with some degree of success and showed some understanding of the suffering of the native population in Canada and what they've been through.
Some people even say that he had a lot of compassion for the native people, and we thank him for those actions.
Yes, I did acknowledge that it was a, depending on who you talk to, but it was a reasonable handling and compassionate handling of the file. And even many native leaders had said at the end that they were sad to see him go and sad to see the shift in the person they are dealing with earlier this year when he was appointed Minister of Immigration in the cabinet shuffle. Long story short, Mark Miller is an effective person in the current cabinet in the government of Canada, the problem was not with Mark Miller, although some of his statements about Palestine echoed a one-sided view totally. But the bigger problem is the government of Canada as a whole, in which he is playing a major part or a big part. The government of Canada, since the beginning of the attack, is repeating a chorus that just says Israel has the right to defend itself, Hamas is a terrorist organization. Israel has the right to defend itself, Hamas is a terrorist organization, as if they're reading from a rule book. And Israel takes that and uses it as a justification in front of the world, not only by Canada, of course, because the same chorus is unfortunately being followed to the letter by four or five of the Western nations, including the United States and Britain, France, Germany, and takes that and uses it to do whatever it wants to the civilian population. And then where are the voices that were loud and clear about not attacking civilians when it comes to killing thousands of civilians in Gaza, over 500, and now probably the number keeps increasing by the day? I honestly don't follow these numbers because I hate it when I feel that people are just numbers. But the fact is that hundreds of children and a couple of thousands, at least, of civilians have now been killed in Gaza, and nobody's been saying it's terrorists to target civilians. I mean, if we consider Hamas a terrorist organization, and we're not here to talk about Hamas, really, I'm not here to talk about Hamas, but I do consider the Israeli Defense Force a terrorist organization and the Israeli government a terrorist organization, because all what they are doing is terrorize civilians to get their way. They have been that for decades. And it's time the Canadian government speaks up, and that's why we blockaded Mark Miller's office today, and that's why we are determined to blockade other government ministers, and there are many of them in Montreal, including the Prime Minister himself, offices, till they listen, until they come to their senses.
Now, I want to also quote that last October, Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the EU Commission, stated, quote, Russia attacks against civilian infrastructure in Ukraine, especially electricity, are war crimes. Cutting of off men, women, children of water, electricity, and heating with winter coming, these are acts of pure terror. And we have to call it as such. But now, unfortunately, they are not doing the same with the Israeli attack on Gaza. I think one of the casualties of this situation is that we don't see the Western world as a defender of human rights. Your comments.
You said it. You said it, Sema, and thank you for quoting that quote from Ursula von der Leyen, because it is the exact situation right now, the exact situation. And not one Western country, the United Nations did, but not one Western country said that this is unacceptable. This is a crime against humanity. This is a crime against the civilian population. Collective punishment in the biggest open air prison. You know that I and many others have been saying this for two decades now. Yet the West expects that the people of Gaza will just submit after all these years. And they are surprised when they rise up in any kind of action, as if, wow, where is this coming from? It is coming from generations being brought up under siege, under lack of resources, and without hope. The biggest, most important point is, when you have no hope, you do anything. And that is where we find ourselves. And oops, Israel is surprised. Really?
Now, we also have to say, in fairness, that some organizations like the World Health Organization strongly condemned Israel for its repeated orders for the evacuation of 22 hospitals, treating more than 2,000 inpatients in northern Gaza. This was a death sentence for the sick and injured, as three times U.S. presidential candidate Ralph Nader commented, where are people on ventilators receiving dialysis and babies in incubators going to evacuate to? So even acknowledging that some institutions like the World Health Organization and Oxfam have condemned and have spoken for the plight of the Palestinian people, it seems that they have no power to act. So we have to go one level further. What were your demands from our government, our present government, concerning this situation?
The first and topmost thing is stop giving Israel this carte blanche by just repeating the two statements that Israel is that Hamas is a terrorist organization and that Israel has the right to defend itself. Stop saying that, because that is not the issue right now. The issue right now is, if you want a just solution, you should talk about the rights of the Palestinian people. This is the only long-term solution. But right now, where we are right now, where is the call by the Canadian government to restore water and electricity to the civilian population of Gaza? Where is the call to Israel to stop bombing civilians indiscriminately? Where is the call to Israel to stop this deportation of orders of deporting masses under the threat of you're going to be killed? All those are civilian masses. That is what Canada should say right now. These are our demands. And these demands are not demands that are biased towards the Palestinian people or special for the Palestinian people. These are demands we would make, I would make, about any population in such a similar situation of imbalance of power where millions of civilians, millions, we're talking millions now. When I used to visit Gaza, it was 1.3 million. Now it's 2.3 million people living in the same space, and they are being collectively punished by Israel. Canada should speak up.
You have been to Gaza, Ihab, as part of the Freedom Flotilla. Can you tell us about your experience there very briefly so that our listeners could get a feeling of what it is to be under siege, to be cut from the world, because Gaza was called the biggest prison on earth now?
It is. My experience, I mean, I visited Gaza twice, and that was before my... before my attempt to break the blockade with the Freedom Flotilla in 2011, I had visited Gaza twice before, and I actually just posted on my Facebook a video I took in Gaza when I was there in 2009, and it was mostly children videos in the refugee camps. Just again, for our listeners who don't know, the majority of the population of Gaza is itself refugees and descendants of refugees who escaped what is now the state of Israel to Gaza in 1948. And I will segue here and say that when you tell those people to leave their homes again, all what happens is that it brings out this collective memory of please leave in 1948 till the war ends and then come back. And they never did. And now you're telling them the same thing again. It's not easy for the people. It's not just a simple thing like leave till we rebuild your homes or something. So anyway, I did visit Gaza in 2008 and 2009, and I saw the life in those refugee camps, the kids that are growing up there without hope, the sewers that are going into the sea water without any treatment. I saw all that with my own eyes. Then 2 years later in 2011, I was on one of the Freedom Flotilla boats that was boarded by the Israeli Navy, and we were taken and imprisoned in Israel. And the Freedom Flotilla work that I did after that, organizing missions after that, although I didn't sail on the boats myself, was towards the same goal, which is this blockade of Gaza has to end. Otherwise, there will be bigger problems for everybody. And that's what Israel and the West keep living in denial about. If you want this to continue forever, then continue the same way of treating the Palestinians.
In fact, Ismail Haniyeh, the political representative of Hamas, said, we're not going anywhere. We're staying on our grounds. So... give the illusion that the Gazans are going to flood into Egypt and that Israel will take whatever remains of the land.
You know, Sam, I have to say that I very much appreciate those who stay steadfast and sacrifice, but I don't judge those who flee under such conditions.
Absolutely, yeah.
We are sitting here in the comfort of our living rooms or radio stations or offices, and we can't judge, but we do analyze and understand the problem. And I know many people from the families that fled their homes in 1948, and I heard the stories, and it's such a trap that that they know quite well.
Stay with us, Ihab Lutayef. The Islamic Relief Canada is demanding that Canada take action to secure an immediate humanitarian corridor for the delivery of vital aid into Gaza. Prime Minister Trudeau has now publicly stated that Canada is calling for a humanitarian corridor and unimpeded access for aid into Gaza. This is a significant development. However, this must be followed with action from the Canadian government. To see the full press release, please refer to the Islamic Relief Canada website. When we come back, we continue our conversation about Israel and Palestine. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM on the dial, www.ckut.ca on the internet. We have some announcements here. Actually, I got this message from Rania Arabi. I pray for peace and I'm holding the light for me and for all of us. May the divine help us all in these trying times that want to pull us into darkness. May we choose love. May we rise above its interests and schemes and stand on the solid ground of justice and peace for all, and listen to our feelings and torn apart hearts. We are all one. We keep forgetting that what we do to one another, we do to ourselves. I pray for the healing of our hearts, strength, and courage in these most challenging times. So this was one message that we just received. In the studio with us, we have Sin Gomery, and she's going to talk about Word Beyond War. Welcome to our show, Sin, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's the first time that I have the pleasure to interview you, Sin, so if you would like to tell us a few words about what is Word Beyond War.
World Beyond War is a global movement to end the institution of war. And it functions with chapters in various places all over the world. I'm the coordinator of the Montreal chapter, Montreal for a World Beyond War.
And I understand you had a press release concerning the situation in Israel-Palestine.
We issued a statement right after the initial attack, just to say we stand with Palestine. And I think there was it was a horrific attack, and the Hamas attack I'm talking about. And it was a horrific attack, but at the same time, I recognized that all the world at that moment was turned on the side of Israel, or so it seemed from the mainstream media and from our own governments and so on. So I felt that somebody had to stand up for Palestine and to recognize that this was not an isolated incident. This was the product of many, many years of oppression, and I think it's 48 years that Palestinians, that since the 1948 was the Nakba, and it's been 15 years that they've been living in the largest open-air prison in the world. Is that right? So obviously, I mean, this wasn't something out of the blue, and you can, if you give people the option of either, you know, living in a prison and lying down and dying and seeing their children killed in the street, or eventually rising up and trying to change the situation, it's not surprising that they would rise up.
Sin Gomery, can you give us some examples where you really intervened to prevent war or to take a stand for peace?
Okay, we function there's been three, in here, just here in Montreal, there's been three major demonstrations since this horrible genocide was unleashed. And I have attended two of the three. I didn't attend the one, the emergency one, last night after the hospital bombing. But we do attend demonstrations. We do letter writing campaigns. We do statements. We do webinars. We educate. We network with people all over with people in the other chapters all over the world, and attempt to learn what we can. World Beyond War is a really fantastic organization, in my opinion, because it's global and it's very much hands-on, very inventive, and the few staff that they have are always there to help you realize any campaign. We've had movie campaigns, we've had all kinds of fun actions to educate people, and I've learned so much myself as a leader in the past 2 years of the chapter. I'd like to talk, if I may, a little bit about just colonialism.
At
some point.
Okay. Go ahead. Okay. How would you link it to the situation?
Yes, I just think that I have heard that colonialism is not a historical event. Colonization is an ongoing project, even here in Canada. Now, we tend to like to think of colonialism as something in our history, and that's all past, and thank you very much, it's finished. No, it's an ongoing project, and that's why we have so many problems here in Canada with Indigenous peoples who don't have equal... They don't have equal political sway. They generally live in poverty. They're overrepresented in the prisons, etc. There's a reason for that, and it's colonialization. Recently in Australia, another colonial state, they had actually historically a vote just the past week or so to have representation in their parliament of the Maori people.
Maori.
Yes. Okay. And it was shot down. I mean, it's the prisoners voting whether to release the prisoners. The prison guards were voting to release the prisoners. It's not democratic at all. And here today, actually in Manitoba, the NDP now has a NDP MP who is Indigenous, and that's a historical first. But I digress. All this to say that the reason that the Liberal Trudeau government so steadfastly repeats this ridiculous line about Israel has a right to defend itself is in part because Canada sells millions and millions of dollars each year of weapons to Israel and makes a lot of money on it. But the other reason is that Canada is itself a colony and they see it's a slippery slope if they allow anything to change in the colonial reality. If the Palestinians were given equal rights and were given restitution for the land that they lost and allowed equal place in society, then obviously Canada and every other colonial society would have to do the same.
And what are your demands?
Well, I haven't heard Trudeau call for a ceasefire. I haven't heard really any significant standing up for the life that is going to be lost in what is becoming an ethnic cleansing right now in Palestine. It's a very, very scary time, and the hospital was bombed yesterday, little babies, corpses all over the place, and children crying with blood-spattered faces. I think this is a horrific thing, and I don't hear the outcry that you would expect to hear in the face of such horror. And after the glamorization of the Second World War and all we hear about Nazis, I should mention Nazis and Zionists are two faces of the same coin. They're both racist ideologies. They're both really, the Nazis proposed what they called a final solution. This seems to be what's being enacted right now, a final solution to get rid of the Palestinians once and for all, take over the land, their end of problem, there's no more people to make us feel guilty about the land that we stole. So it's a very, very scary time, and we have to stand up and do whatever we can to stop this before it's too late.
And I read from your press release that occupied people have a right to resist a foreign occupation under international law.
Thank you so much for mentioning that. Yes, that is true. They do. Years ago, Frantz Fanon wrote a book called The Wretched of the Earth, and he basically shocked the world by saying, when people are oppressed and people are colonized, eventually they're going to... violence is going to be their only way out. And nothing has changed, and that's still true.
And you also use...
But it's legal because it's recognized that that's true, but nobody is recognizing or mentioning that in the mainstream press.
And I also read that Israel is acting with genocidal intent, cutting off food, water, electricity. These are war crimes, crimes against humanity of the highest order. And just to talk about the concept of genocide, we're going to listen at what a specialist says to Democracy Now.
Thank you for having me. I think that indeed what we're seeing now in Gaza is a case of genocide. We have to understand that the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide from 1948 requires that we see special intent for genocide to happen. And to quote the convention, intent to destroy a group as defined as racial, ethnic, religious, or national, as such, that is collectively, not just individuals. And this intent, as we just heard, is on full display by Israeli politicians and army officers. Since 7th of October, we heard Israel's president. It's well known what Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said on 9th of October, declaring a complete siege on Gaza, cutting off water, food, fuel, stating that we're fighting human animals and we will react accordingly. He also said that we will eliminate everything. We know that Israeli army spokesperson Daniel Hagari, for example, acknowledged one-tune destruction and said explicitly the emphasis is on damage and not on accuracy. So we're seeing this special intent on full display. And really, I have to say, if this is not special intent to commit genocide, I really don't know what is. So when we look at the actions taken, the dropping of thousands and thousands of bombs in a couple of days, including phosphorus bombs, as we heard, on one of the most densely populated areas around the world, together with these proclamations of intent, this indeed constitutes genocidal killing, which is the first act, according to the convention, of genocide. And Israel, I must say, is also perpetrating act number 2 and 3 that is causing serious bodily or mental harm, and creating condition designed to bring about the destruction of the group by cutting off water, food, supply of energy, bombing hospitals, ordering the fast evictions of hospitals, which the World Health Organization has declared to be, quote, a death sentence. So we're seeing the combination of genocidal acts with special intent. This is indeed a textbook case of genocide.
Can you talk about the displacement? Israel saying that the entire northern Gaza...
This was broadcast on Democracy Now, coming back to Sin Gomery. Calling Palestinians, quote, human animals, is genocidal language and hate speech. Would you like to comment on what appears in your press release?
Well, it's well known that using terms like that and using imagery like that is what genocidal regimes do in order to get in order to dehumanize the other and to affect the genocides that they plan to do. And there hasn't been really a lot of pushback against that. There's been so many war crimes. There's use of white phosphorus is a war crime. The bombs that Israel is using, like today with the hospital, they claimed that Hamas couldn't have dropped those bombs because Hamas uses rockets that don't do as much damage as those bombs, those what they call bunker buster GDAMs, American-made bombs, is the type of bomb that was dropped on that hospital, and hundreds of people died in a single moment. I mean, it's just horrific. And we see Biden defending. Biden is the Nord Stream bomber. I follow Cy Hirsch, who's the journalist that revealed the My Lai massacre, among other things. And he has the inside story, talking with CIA people and insider people in Israel and so on. And the intention is there. Israel intends to flatten Gaza and raise it, completely destroy it, not just kill people, but completely make Gaza like it never existed. And that's his intention, and everybody's watching, and nobody is reacting in an appropriate manner to what's happening before their eyes.
Sin, you talked in your press release about stop sending weapons to Israel. Do you think that encouraging them with weapons is a major cause for this war to go on?
Yes, I think that's been a long time problem of Canada's, is that we are complicit in various wars. We're complicit in the war in Yemen as well, with weapons sales. It's a lot of $5 billion of weapons sales made in Ontario, in small town London, Ontario, were used by the Saudi Arabia in the war against Yemen. There's lots of, Canada has, right here on the island of Montreal, there are 4 or 5 weapons manufacturers that are selling weapons to Israel. So that's going to be a campaign that we at World Beyond War have. And the larger peace community has going forward, is we're going to target those quote businesses unquote, and reveal what they're doing and make people understand the connection between it's a complicity and it's a conflict of interest for the Canadian government to put itself forward as a peacemaker or a neutral party and at the same time be profiting massively from wars around the world.
In fact, the Palestinian trade unions are asking for the Western world not to send weapons to Israel.
In the long term, yeah, that's what I'd like to see. In the short term, I just liked Justin Trudeau to open his mouth and say, I call for a ceasefire. I haven't heard any Canadian politician. There's one NDP politician, I think, that... I can't remember her name right now, but that has called for a ceasefire.
Would it be Nikki Ashton?
No.
From the NDP?
It was Matheson, something Matheson.
Irene Matheson? No.
Anyway, there has been somebody that said something to that effect, but generally there's just silence. The silence is complicity. The Western governments, I mean, Biden is visiting, and patting the back of Netanyahu right now, today. So it's pretty horrific what we're seeing. We're seeing Israel is a terrorist state. The United States is a terrorist state. Canada is complicit. Canada is not directly maybe a terrorist state, but we are certainly complicit with all the terrorism that's going on. Let's be honest. Let's call the real terrorists out here.
I want to read this. During May 2021, Unity Intifada, a collective of Palestinian trade unions, called for international solidarity from international unions, urging them to divest their pensions from companies implicated in the occupation and released statements of solidarity. So this we need immediately.
Yes.
You also talked about a ceasefire, and we forget the issue of the hostages and the prisoners, and this should be also a humanitarian priority.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And the scary thing is that they just seem to be sitting back, and almost like the Israelis watching the bombs falling. They're just sitting back and letting this genocide unfurl. I mean, people have no water, they have no food, they have no electricity. The hospital has been bombed. You know, it's a humanitarian crisis. Stop bombing them, first of all, and then get people out. I can't believe even Melanie Joly was on the television recently saying, oh, we can't repatriate Canadian dual citizenships right now because it would be very expensive. I couldn't believe it. I mean, after Canada is making so much money from selling weapons to these countries, and now when people need to get out in a crisis, it's like, it won't be too expensive. That's not in our budget. You know, I said maybe she could use some of the billions of dollars in weapon sales profits to get the people out. But
and Israeli Canadians have been evacuated recently. They crossed to Jordan.
Just manifestly racist. We're seeing just manifestly racist behavior. Yeah.
We just have a few minutes left in our program, so I would like your final comments of Ihab Lutayef and Sin Gomery.
Well, one thing, I don't differ with Sin, but I want to add something. I don't think that the alliance that Canada has with Israel is just because of the economic reasons. I think we are falling into the global vision of the West on how to control the Middle East, and Israel is the tool there.
Yes.
and the lobby here that is strong. I mean, we
yes.
I don't want to be one-sided why Canada is supporting Israel. The other thing is that there is also a rift even within the Liberal caucus right now, where there are MPs, backbenchers, who are starting to talk about a ceasefire. And I think there is a surprise that's happening there. I'm not saying I'm optimistic. I'm saying that there is a limit to what people can take, and there must be MPs of conscience in our House of Commons. There must be. There can't be just silent people who say yes, sir, to the government. So we work on the ground. Your press release is great, and it covers so many aspects. Yeah. And I think that we need to just keep pushing as much as we can to get an outcome of this disaster that we're in right now that will help make tomorrow better than today and not have a repeat again.
I'll tell you one thing. Thank you for saying all that, Ihab. I agree with you 100%. One thing that gives me a glimmer of hope, you reminded me, is reading Cy Hirsch, and he was talking about, somebody on the inside was talking about, that they were, before they were going to drop these bunker busters, which would basically, you know, there's underground tunnels where Hamas fighters are hiding, and these would just blast deep into the earth and kill everything and destroy everything for miles around. And he said something to the effect that Netanyahu was waiting to see, you know, about public opinion, kind of seeing when it would get social acceptability to do that, and waiting for the right moment. And it was going to happen on Monday, and I was terrified all day Monday, and it didn't happen. Now they've bombed a hospital. But my point is that we do have more power than we realize as citizens on the ground and citizens in some of the safer, you know, countries where we can still protest, where we can still exercise our so-called democratic right in our so-called democracies. So we should do that. There's a demonstration on Sunday that I know of here in Montreal. And there's all kinds of letter writing campaigns. As I say, we have this, rightly said, weapons sales is just a tiny bit of the whole thing. But we have letter writing campaigns. You can write to your MPs. You can get them to show a little backbone and to stand up for a ceasefire. And that's what's needed. There's many, many things that we can do, and the world is watching, and we do have more power than we realize.
Thank you very much, St. Montgomery. And I would suggest to our listeners to go to your website, Beyond Ward. And thank you very much, Ehab Lutayev, for being with us. Very much appreciated. And this brings us to the end of our program today from CKUT of the Hour. The music is by Simon Shaheen. Thank you for listening. Don't turn the dial or don't. CKUT, your favorite radio station.
Thank you for tuning in to Off the Hour. If you're interested in the issues raised in today's show, and if you want to help the plight of the Palestinian people, please keep your eyes peeled for an upcoming fundraiser at La Sala Rosa this coming Monday, the 23rd of October, organized by our very own Jack here at the station. It's set to be a night of music and a lot of fun, and hopefully a lot of money raised. That's this coming Monday, 23rd of October, La Sala Rosa, 4848 St. Laurent Boulevard. Thank you again for listening, and stay tuned for more people-powered radio.
And so I want to thank, first of all, Brick Pa Brick for hosting us. It's a live transmission. And also to our panelists. I will maybe first start to introduce each panelist, and we'll go that way. And you'll hear about their respective work. So I'd just ask each panelist to briefly introduce themselves. And we'll start just here beside me, Hubert Jérôme Blais, who's an artist and has been involved in housing organizing at a community-based level for a bunch of years in different capacities. So maybe just briefly introduce yourself and also the recent project that you've been working on.
Yeah, hi, thank you.